I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Mark Burry joins me again. The author and historian has just published a new book out this week, Crosses in the Sky, Jean de Brebeuf and the Destruction of Huronia. It's described as the first secular biography of Brebeuf and engagingly recounts the missionary's life and tragic story, while adding perhaps a fuller understanding of Canada's history. In the early 1600s, with the arrival of the Jesuits, the Catholic Church's most zealous warriors for Christ, it's a collision of two worlds, what with their desire to create their own nation on the Great Lakes. And as the Huron Confederacy's already established, it's fascinating to read about what sort of society it is, especially that it's a matriarchal society, and how the conflict with the Jesuits begins. At the center is Brebeuf, the mystic who sought a martyr's death, whose values and often bizarre spirituality are throughout the book. I'll ask Mark, who I spoke with 2 weeks ago from his home in Ottawa, about the letters and documents he drew upon in the course of his research, as well as the history taken down and spread by the Jesuits themselves. And I'll get Mark to reflect on why the life of Brebeuf is important to know about, especially as we seek a fuller perspective of the history of this place, Canada. Mark Burry is an author, lawyer, and journalist. He holds postgraduate degrees in journalism and history, as well as a Juris Doctor degree. He was called to the bar in 2018. He's won numerous awards for his journalism and writing, like the 2020 RBC Charles Taylor Prize for his book Bushrunner, The Adventures of Pierre Esprit Radisson, which he was on the program with after it came out. Visit markburry.com for more information. This new book is from Biblioasis. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program, Mark Burry. Dr. Burry, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. This is such an engaging book. I didn't think I'd find it interesting, but your talents as a writer comes through, because you take something and someone from the 17th century and make him relevant to today. But you say something early in the book that I think is important, that we shouldn't look at him from a 21st century lens. I guess that's an important thing to consider, because a lot of us who read it in 2024 or later are tempted to do that.
And I think we really don't have the ability to do that through that kind of lens, because we don't understand enough about how people saw the world back then and the world that they live in. I try to sort of paint a picture of that world, but to say that somebody who is doing something in the 17th century doesn't really sort of fit with our values now is kind of irrelevant in a way. I mean, you can look at a person's really basic things, I think, and say, I can't possibly agree with this, or I can't even tolerate it. I mean, if the person was a murderer or a rapist or a racist or whatever. But when you're looking at somebody who has a set of values and sort of a project that they're working on, like Ray Booth did, I think you have to understand their own motivations. And then judge them, if you're going to judge them at all, by whether these people were acting in good faith or not. I think it's really hard to go much farther than that.
Mm. But in terms of his relevance to understanding Canadian history, I mean, he is an important figure that we all should know about, right?
Well, Canadian history and where we are, it starts there. It starts at the time when the French made contact with Indigenous people in the St. Lawrence Valley and the Great Lakes. And they set the stage for everything that happened after that. So in this book, they're setting up residential schools. They're trying to change Indigenous people into Europeans by basically taking control of their country, showing them sort of what they thought was the better way, giving them new technology. They wanted to teach them how to do more efficient farming.
Uh-huh.
And this is something that comes through for hundreds of years afterwards. And so there's that part of the book where it, really an examination of where we started in terms of Indigenous relations in Canada. And the second part of it is to understand French-Canadian culture, where Brébeuf is a huge part of the idea that French-Canadians and their culture had to fight to survive over so many generations. First, they were trying to survive the Iroquois Confederacy when the Iroquois fought them. And they fought to survive when they were conquered by the British. And then they fought to survive within Canada. And now they're fighting to survive within a world that's becoming more and more sort of English-speaking,
yeah,
with things like the Internet and mass media. So there's this constant, what they call Quebec, this constant desire for survivance, for survival. And Brébeuf is sort of the first victim in all this, the first victim of these sort of outside forces that are constantly trying to destroy the French fact in North America. And so I think it's really good to take a look at him and say, okay, well, you know, was he just sort of walking through the bush minding his own business, or what was he doing? What were the circumstances around the destruction of the Jesuit mission, which is the first thrust into the interior of North America by the French regime? And were the people, were the Hurons themselves a group of people who were victims, or were they part of an ongoing struggle among the First Nations of the Great Lakes region? And the answer, of course, is the latter. There was constant struggle among the Iroquoian people, the agricultural people of the Great Lakes. And it had been going on before Europeans arrived in there, when things like trade patterns changed and epidemics happened. This really stimulates a horrific amount of warfare that had a huge impact on the colonial history of Canada.
Well, we'll talk about what was happening in Huronia as the Jesuits arrived. But what you do in the book is you also set the scene in terms of what was happening in Europe and why people like Brébeuf, why Jesuits like him go elsewhere. I mean, things weren't great in Europe, were they? I mean, there's a lot of wars, a lot of conflict and plagues. And it's a time of great change as well as uncertainty, which to put together, I guess, don't make for a good time. And people do leave, don't they?
Yeah, and it's something that they didn't really teach us in school. We had this idea that settlers came over from, you know, a little bit overcrowded Europe,
yeah,
or that they were coming because they didn't like the government or they wanted some freedom or something. But, you know, we never see Europe as this mess. And at the time that Brébeuf came and Champlain came and the first, I'm doing air quotes here, explorers came to Canada,
yeah,
Europe was a basket case. There had been religious warfare for almost 100 years. Big areas of Germany were destroyed, like literally flattened. There were wars that were going on when Brébeuf was among the Huron in Europe, where more people died per capita than died in those same areas in the Second World War. Mm. And it was a time of real revolution. And this, it's not sort of a gentle connection between North America and Europe. It's these horrible conflicts in Europe spilling out into the world. And people in France and people in England and other countries sort of grabbing a chunk of the rest of the world to try to shape it their way, or in terms of the Jesuits, literally take it over and have their side in this European conflict be the dominant thing in what they would think of as the New World. So, yeah, it was like the 20th century in a lot of ways, the first half of the 20th century especially, mm-hmm, where it was constant trouble. And the whole rest of the world wasn't doing all that well either. But troubles that people had in North America were really fired up when they hit this very militarized, determined group of Europeans. These were not your parish. These were not parish priests coming to your town to build a church.
Right.
These were the shock
In terms of you described, you mentioned the parish priest a moment ago. I'm nominally a Catholic, grew up in it. I'm not a terribly religious person, but I always wondered what the difference was between, say, a Jesuit and the rest of the Catholics. I mean, there is a difference in terms of how they see heaven and hell, among other things, right?
Yeah. The Jesuits were, all of the other religious orders were really fearful and suspicious of the Jesuits. And the Jesuits had very powerful connections, and so they elbowed their way into North America. They pushed out all the other priests that were who were less militant, who were trying to quietly convert the Huron and the Algonquins. And their view was not the view that most Catholics would have today.
Yeah,
I think I pretty much match you. I'm pretty much a lapsed Catholic, went through the Catholic school system, but I never saw the world as a place where Satan was physically, literally here.
Mm.
Now, when Brébeuf is wandering through the Huron country and going from village to village and having an awful lot of hostility most of the time, he believed, he truly believed that Satan, physical incarnations of Satan and other devils, were among the people that were his opponents, that he was fighting a battle in this plane of existence between himself and the devil. And he and the rest of the Jesuits also believed that you went to hell if you weren't baptized. It's something the Catholic Church itself didn't even agree with.
Yeah.
They believed that if you were a good person and you had no opportunity to be baptized or reject Jesus, there was no reason why you couldn't go to heaven. But the Jesuits were determined to baptize as many people as they could, believing that they were literally saving them from an eternity of physical pain and damnation. So when you believe that, if you believe those two things, that there are actual people / devils around you trying to do you in, and that you have to baptize anybody, everybody you can, to keep them from this horrible fate, then you're going to do things that most people today wouldn't even consider. And you're going to take risks to do that. And especially if you think that your own salvation depends on you succeeding in that.
Yeah, so this is a guy who takes his idea of morality and religion to an extreme. He also has these visions. Some people think of him as a mystic, but when you look at him in hindsight, what's your take on these rather unpleasant visions that he did have? I mean, did you wonder about his mental state at that point?
Oh, a lot. I think that a lot of people today who see him as a saint and a mystic have a double standard. One would be that back then, if these things happened to you, if you saw skeletons running through the bush, or hags came up to you and slapped your face, or ghosts offered you sex, or crosses floated through the sky, or whatever, that maybe you needed some psychiatric help in this day and age. And for some reason, people are willing to say, well, this is sort of mystical, heaven-sent visions.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that, especially considering that he was the only person in that mission who had those kind of visions, supposedly, except for a couple times when people said they saw ghosts. I mean, he's there with a bunch of other priests for quite a while. But he's having these things all the time, and his colleagues see this as a sign of holiness. Though I do suspect that some of them thought maybe he needed to get out for a while, because they did send him back to Quebec.
Yeah.
And just kind of had him in a quiet place for a while. But when he came back, all these visions came roaring back. And they were part of the motivation that he had. And these visions pushed him along to be even more extreme, to the point where he did so many things that the Huron people didn't like, and he had a good reason to be afraid for his own safety, because he generated so much hostility from them.
Yeah. Back to Huronia and the Huron and what it was like before the Jesuits arrived. I found that very interesting to read about how society was, say, structured before the Jesuits. It was a very matriarchal society, wasn't it?
It was matriarchal, and women had very strong defined rights. I mean, we're not talking about New Age people or some sort of Bush hippies or communists or anything. These Hurons were very into trading. They were very profit motivated. They had connections all over Eastern North America. They were quite wealthy people. They're not what we think of as indigenous people living by hunting, whatever. These are people who live in towns in an area that's mostly clear with thousands of acres of cornfields and stuff. And this is the food they trade around. And they believe in a lot in premarital sex. They believe in women's right to divorce. They believe in women's right to have child support when a marriage breaks up. These are things that the Jesuits cannot get their hands around. Mm. And behind the scenes, especially, women have tremendous power because they're picking the chiefs. They don't sit in the councils when decisions are made, but there are times when they come up from behind the curtain and they make things happen. So it's quite a bit of a different culture from the very patriarchal culture of France, and certainly something the Jesuits had a hard time understanding.
And so begins, I guess, their cross purposes and the destruction of... Was the destruction of the Huron society always the plan?
No, not at all. It was the unintended consequence of what they thought were good deeds. The Hurons were destroyed because when the Jesuits came in and really worked hard to convert so many Hurons, it split their society right in half. And so they were a very divided country. It was already a confederacy. You're living in a very, very small area. I'd say about the area of Greater Vancouver.
Uh-huh.
But you had started off with about 20,000 to 30,000 people, so it's quite heavily populated for North America at that time for a place of that size. And all of their trading partners and their enemies or potential enemies, they're about the same size. There's a lot of balance there, and with the same weapons and the same skills and everything. But when their society is split, and they had been very dominant in trade and often dominant militarily, when they're split, it gives their enemies this huge opportunity to come in and wipe them out. And it doesn't help that their enemies, who were the Five Nations, the Iroquois Confederacy, got guns from the Dutch, hundreds and hundreds of guns at the end, and the Hurons only had a few. So they're outgunned, divided, and it seems that the Jesuits, who were very, very brilliant in many ways, didn't see the impact of that split and how it would be exploited.
I'm skipping around here because there's so much to cover, but it's such a fascinating book, and I hope we're giving people listening to us who haven't picked up the book yet a reason to do so. When you look back at Brebeuf's legacy, there are obviously things that don't work in his favor, I guess, if we're tallying up whether we like the guy or not. The consequences of his actions, I think I'm wondering, do the Jesuits in hindsight see where whatever they thought they were doing didn't? Like when you read Relations, for example, their history of what went on, do you think they see how what they did was probably not good, perhaps?
That's a really good question. At the time, and going, so they kept their missions going, even though the Huronian mission was wiped out. They pivoted fast, and one of the first things they did was they went to the Huron's enemies and tried to convert them, and they did a fairly good job eventually of converting quite a few Iroquois to Catholicism. So, it really wasn't all about the Huron with them. It was about finding someone to do this with. But they don't really get it while they're in Canada before, say, the conquest of Quebec and the transfer of Canada in 1763. But I really want to be fair to the Jesuits and say they get it now. It took a long time, but they understand what happened in Huronia, I believe, and it's the idea of Brebeuf being this hero who had to bleed to get the Christian message out has finally been abandoned after many, many, many years, after centuries. That aspect of his heroism, I think, has been And in places like the, there's actually a big church next to where the mission fort was. And for many years, they had a painting behind the altar of the eight North American martyrs in heaven. And then underneath was their deaths, and some were being tortured, and some were being hit over the head with axes and shot and stuff. And it was only a few years ago that they basically they covered up the bottom of that. So without the paintings of the martyrs in heaven, but this imagery of their pain and suffering has been covered. And even I talk about Brabus' skull in the book,
the relic,
the last
chapter.
Yeah, this relic. They actually when they found his body where he was killed, they took him and buried him, and then they retrieved his skull, and it's been kept for almost 400 years now. But it was the Jesuits in Quebec who had part of it, because it was cut in half at one point. Finally, just handed it over to the church in Midland, Ontario, because they said it's not relevant to what we do. We're doing outreach with drug addicted young people in Quebec City, and the skull of this priest who tried to convert the Huron just is not relevant to what we do now. So I do think they get it now in the States. There's a shrine to the three Jesuits who were killed there during this mission, and that's a whole different kettle of fish. That's very political. There's a lot of anti-Indigenous stuff going on there. It's a sort of charismatic Catholic thing.
Yeah.
So the Jesuits in Canada especially have really moved on from this, but it took a while.
I looked up the relic last night in preparing for a chat, and I noticed that it was on tour through parts of the United States earlier this year. So I guess that's a wonderful sense of where or how it's being used today and where it's being used, as well as, I think, illustrative of what you just said.
I've seen people mob it. I literally had to hide under an altar when it was outside at an event. This is in the early 90s when I was working for the Toronto Star, and I was writing a piece about the return of the skull, or half of the skull, to Midland. And they had it on this big altar outside, and people swarmed over it. There's this idea that it can cure people, and lots of people still believe that.
Yeah.
And I had to duck and cover. So yeah, and if you look, if you Google the skull, and I'm pretty sure that you and I saw the same thing, and you see people touching the glass case it's in, or sort of flopped over it, and it's rather odd, but it is part of the faith of some people, and so I guess it's good PR for the martyr shrine in Midland and stuff to take it on the road. It's odd. Traveling skulls are really weird in my life.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's freaky because not only is it a skull, it's you can tell that it's been really worked over by somebody. It's got big scratches on it and stuff from, you know. So it's a pretty nasty thing.
Yeah. So your book, Mark, is a secular look at Brebeuf and his times. What was it like to research it, especially when the scholarship on Brebeuf and these times, generally done by the Jesuits themselves? I mean, did you find their work reliable, say?
There was a lot of things about it. There were a lot of things about it that you had to discount.
Sure.
And a lot of hostility to anybody who was critical of the Jesuit mission, or even of Champlain and the authorities in France that allowed the Jesuits to be the only group of priests that were allowed into Canada at that point. The one good thing to the Jesuits was that for something that happened almost 400 years ago, the record is incredible. There aren't many things, I think, in the world that are as well documented as the destruction of Huronia. Certainly no other aspect of contact between Europeans and indigenous people, say in the first like 250 years of contact, is documented in any way as well as that. There were a couple of other priests around who weren't Jesuits at the very, very beginning. There's a guy named Segard who goes to Huronia actually before Brebeuf, and he writes a beautiful book because he actually really liked the Hurons, and I don't think the Jesuits truly did. Mm-hmm. And I look through that material and I see things that they probably didn't so you've got the Jesuit material, and then there's been a lot of archaeological work, too. Mm-hmm. So that kind of helps tell what the Hurons were doing and how much this trade was worth to them. And that's such an important part of the story. It's what the fur trade meant to them, because they were bringing a little bit of stuff. These people were carrying tons and tons and tons of metal stuff and clothing and blankets and things into the interior and trading them. It was a huge business for them. It made them really well off, and it caused a lot of the strife between the people who were making on this thing and everybody else who were the victims of the epidemics and stuff that came along with it. So that was quite handy. And then there was some decent scholarship, say, in the last 40 years or so. And there's a lot of really bad stuff. It's just poorly done and speculative and sloppy. It's a period that was written about a lot. Even though there were only two biographies of Bright Books ever written, and they were both written by Jesuits, there's an awful lot of other stuff that's just wonky. And even the archaeology is often quite bad. So I had to wade through a lot of stuff, but I've been reading this all my life. Because I grew up in that area, and my dad's family has lived there since, but has lived there since the 1850s. And we actually owned part of the site of the Jesuit fort in the 1800s. And I have relatives that built the interior of the Martyr Shrine in Midland. And, you know, so there's a lot of this story crosses my family's story and my own story, life story, quite often. So I feel quite comfortable with it. I've walked the sites of these villages. I think I've got every book ever written about this. If I've missed anything, I'd be really surprised. And read a lot about the Jesuits and was really intrigued by them. And I have quite a bit of respect for them. So I think it was a matter of picking and choosing, but I tried to be really fair to everybody. And I also wanted to tell a story that wasn't boring, because I get bored easily. And I'll put down a book and just move on if it's boring. And so I want something that I would actually read myself.
Yeah. So what then, after writing the book, Mark, is your assessment of Brebeuf? I mean, did it change from when you started the book to now when it's finished and it's out now?
I thought when I started it that he was a much more successful missionary than he was. I didn't realize what a failure that mission had been through the early years. And I didn't realize how his mental health problems were as bad as they were. I also still believe, after reading all this stuff, that his intentions were not, they weren't bad. He wasn't trying to harm anybody. He was actually really trying to do good to people and good for people. It's one of the great lessons in good intentions, bad results. My opinion of what, you know, who's asked me that? I just think he was like the rest of us. He had a sort of set of ideas and values, and he stumbled through life with them. And sometimes they were right, and sometimes they were wrong. Sometimes he could tell right away.
Yeah.
Sometimes it took 50 years or 100 years, or you know, we're looking back now and understanding things like the women's rights issues, which nobody wrote about in all of the scholarship that people have done since the Jesuit relations. Hardly anybody's ever touched on the fact that they went straight after women's rights among the Huron. And that was something that I twigged to pretty fast. So, and I don't know if any other lawyers ever written about the Huron, but I look at their law and things, I say, well, this is why the society works, because their law works. So, and I know I'm going off on a tangent here, but I think these things were probably really hard for a guy like Brebeuf to figure out and understand.
Yeah.
And so I'll give him credit for that. I also think that he was pig-headed in a lot of ways. I think he didn't even keep up with the doctrines of Catholicism in his own time, especially on things like baptism. And I think that got him into a lot of trouble. He was doing, sneaking around, you know, getting caught sneaking around and baptizing children and stuff, which put them all in danger because, can you imagine if some strangers came along, insisted that they had the right idea about God, and started sneaking around sick kids' hospitals, baptizing dying children? I think we'd have, we probably wouldn't even be as tolerant as the Hurons were about it.
Indeed.
The Hurons only made threats. There was only one time I could find where somebody was actually killed for doing that kind of weird stuff.
It's a fascinating a book and a fascinating story, and I'm enjoying it as I'm reading it. Mark, congratulations on this book, and continue good luck with it. But by the way, are you working on something new now?
Yeah, I'm working on a proposal for another really wacky story, which is the Mohawk expedition up the Nile River in 1884 to rescue General Gordon when he's under siege from the Islamic fundamentalist dervishes, led by the great Mahdi, which is a story that I don't think has ever been told very well to Canadians.
Yeah.
It is as batshit crazy
as
the Brabos story, where you have French Canadians, Irish river raftsmen, Mohawk River guys from the Montreal area, and eight lawyers from Winnipeg with Sikh soldiers, East African porters, pushing and pulling big lifeboat type things up the Nile River to save this Colonel Kurtz type, who had holed up in Khartoum, and was surrounded by thousands and thousands of rather upset and angry Africans. It's it really doesn't fit into our ideas of colonialism at all.
Right, right.
And why Mohawks would go do this? The same, at the time the Real resistance is breaking out in the West. And from what I know of the story, it's going to be a lot of fun for people to read because it is just loaded with great characters.
Well, until then, we'll definitely read Crosses in the Sky. I so appreciate your time today. Thanks for this, Mark.
Well, thank you so much. Take care.
The website for more is at markbury.com. The book is called Crosses in the Sky, Jean de Brebeuf and the Destruction of Huronia. It's published by Biblioasis. Its author, Mark Bury. Join me on the line from Ottawa in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantum.